You're invited to tune in to Bob Inyart Live right here on KLTT.
Bob Inyart, pastor of Denver Bible Church, hosts a conservative talk radio news show.
It's fun.
Hear the O'Reilly O'Reilly segments. Explore the real difference between right
and left wingers.
And learn why liberals call for peace
while conservatives fight for freedom.
So stay tuned to AM 670 KLTT right here on your dial.
And listen to Bob Inyart Live.
This is Bob Inyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278. Greetings to the brightest audience in the country, and welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. I am Bob Inyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Hi, Fred. How are you doing?
I'm doing great and glad to be back.
Fred is also the webmaster for the Creation Research Society. I love those guys. But today we're reporting on an article from another organization, Creation Ministries International. Where are they based?
They're based in Australia, and they're a recent spinoff of Answers in Genesis, and they put out a prestigious publication called the Journal of Creation.
Yes.
Formerly called TJ, formerly called Technical Journal. AIG right. didn't like the word technical because it kind of shied people away, but this journal is great for both scientists and laymen alike. There's articles
it really
that really range from so all great. Disciplines. And
when people get a subscription to this, they come back and thank me because it is so fun.
Oh, it is. It's a great magazine.
So, Fred, we've covered about not even half of the journal in the previous episode, Real Science Friday. One of the arguments I've had a hard time with to prove the young earth, to demonstrate it from the Bible and the world, one of the arguments is the bristlecone pine trees in California in the White Mountains. I've read that they have rings, thousands of rings in those trees, very old, and then some of the trees fall on the ground. And they could match up the patterns of dry seasons, rainier seasons. And so they could connect, okay, this tree that fell on the ground overlapped this one that's still growing by 800 years. We could tell from the ring pattern. So when we put it all together, it goes back over 7,000 years. And that disproves the chronology of the Bible regarding Noah's flood, because these trees could not have survived during Noah's flood. So I've had a hard time explaining that. I've just had a guess that it must be multiple rings per year, but it was just a guess.
Yeah, so essentially what Bob's talking about is they count these tree rings and they assume each ring is formed in a year. And so when you count back, you get ages between 7,000 and 8,000 years, which, as Bob mentioned, contradicts the Genesis chronology. So this article deals with that, and we both found it real interesting. In fact, I think we both found it was our favorite article
this
in the journal.
This is such a great article. I feel like I really understand tree rings and bristlecone pines after reading this article, because it turns out when there is a time of drought, scarce water, bristlecone pines, just like has been documented in other species of gymnosperms and angiosperms, bristlecone pines grow multiple rings per year.
That's right. Again, when they're in a drought condition, and what this article explains is that this is a defense mechanism, so that what it does is it prevents less evaporation out of the bark, so there's more preservation of the water, and that's why it does this.
Mm-hmm. And so this article goes through, you know, standard textbooks on trees. For example, there's an expert in the genus Pinus, pine trees, and he wrote a book called The Genus Pinus, and he wrote in his book that apparently a semblance of annual rings is formed after every rather infrequent cloudburst. And it turns out that a creationist took saplings of bristlecone pines, and all he had to do to get multiple rings per year is simulate a two-week drought. For 2 weeks, absolutely no moisture available to the roots, and you get another ring. And so it turns out that the rings, and these trees in the White Mountains in California, they're growing in one of the driest places on Earth.
That's right. And again, the evolutionist viewpoint on this was always based off of assumptions that are hard to prove over the course of the life of the assumption, in this case, 8,000 years. You know, Bob, it reminds me of the same argument that they use for ice cores. They drill these ice cores and they assume that each year an annual layer is laid down, and they count these ice cores, and sometimes they get up to 100,000 years. Well, I don't know if you heard about that lost squadron they found of those P-38s that was buried under, I think, 250 feet of ice near Greenland.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So those planes must be, what, Bob, maybe about 70,000 years old, based where they were buried in the ice?
Yeah, right.
So maybe the Neanderthals were flying around.
Greenland.
Okay, now, Fred Williams, so how long ago did that plane crash? I remember the story. It was about 50 years ago?
Yeah, roughly 50 years ago.
And so it has so much ice above it now. You hear evolutionists all the time. Well, each microstrata takes a year or takes a million years to build up 6 inches of sediment or whatever. And it turns out, okay, tell me again, how many feet of ice above this plane?
About 250 feet, and so about worth 70,000 or so ice core age years.
Right, and so 50 years equals 70,000 years. The evolutionists hate the fact. They hate the fact that a plane crashed and we're able to measure how much ice has been deposited above the plane in the last 50 years. They hate it.
Yeah. Well, it's just like stalactites that grew in these caves, and they grew over old man-made signs. You know, and these stalactites, they used to tell people that go in these caves how they're formed over tens of thousands of years.
Right.
It's like, wait a minute, what about that? There's a switch over there that says on and off that's right behind that stalactite. Was that there 50,000 years ago? Right. And so a lot of that's been abandoned. They don't teach that as much. Some of this evidence is so shoddy. But the bristlecone pine, we didn't quite understand why multiple rings
were
formed.
Because, okay, multiple rings per year, but this many? And it turns out that the logs that are laying on the floor of the forest in the White Mountains, they were supposedly laying on the ground for more than 7,000 years. And these mountains are made out of rock. And that rock erodes at a rate that scientists measure about a foot every 1,000 years. So in 7,000 years, that'd be 7 feet of erosion of rock. And the wood lays on the ground virtually undisturbed, unmolested. In fact, you can't tell a 7,000-year-old piece from a 2,000-year-old piece. They look about the same. And so somebody should say, well, there's something wrong here. There's something going on that we're not understanding. So it turns out that they have looked at patches of trees, like a clump of trees, hundreds of trees on a hillside. And the trees on the edges of the patch have way more rings. They have thousands of rings compared to the rings and the trees in the center of the patch.
Because they're not getting as much water.
They're getting less water because where the trees start to disappear and thin out, that's where it's too steep to hold water, or the soil gets too thin, it's too rocky. So first the density is real thick, and then it gradually lessens to where the trees can't survive. So the trees in the middle, where the soil is the thickest, where the growth conditions are the best, they have the fewest rings. Now, you'd think it'd be the opposite, because where growth conditions are best, you'd think they'd be growing longer, better. But we now know that the trees will end a ring in order to conserve water.
Exactly.
That's why they end the ring, because the rings begin to thin out and they make a wall. It's like a tree ring wall. It's darker compared to the meatier wood. And so the water obviously can't get out between those cells and through those cells as easily. And so these trees are desperate for water. So when there is a cloudburst, they make a ring. They make a ring. And so now we understand why there are thousands of rings on these trees in the White Mountains. And you know what? The evolutionary presumption left us ignorant.
That's right. This is a great article because it really covers a lot of the details. It's solid. It's rock solid.
Mm-hmm. And again, it quotes secular evolutionary scientists and sources repeatedly. And so we creationists, we say, okay, you're claiming that stalactites prove hundreds of thousands of years. Well, let's do some tests. Let's put markers in. So you find stalactites that are grown in human tunnels and stalagmites, human tunnels, and they grow just like other stalactites. And we went down to Carlsbad Caverns in New Mexico, and I was so eager to hear the official report of what they tell tourists of how long it took these massive stalactites and stalagmites to grow. And their official tour, it's recorded. You listen to it. They say, we don't know how long it took because it depends on the water flow. When there's water flow, they grow. When there's not water flow, they don't grow. And that was the perfect answer.
Exactly.
Because they used to say millions of years.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you went back 20, 30 years, I'm sure that they said millions of years.
Oh, yeah. In fact, there was a sign, just like at Yellowstone, there was a sign at Carlsbad. I forget the details now. We have it in one of our Does God Exist seminars. 200 million years old, 30 million years old, 2 million years old, now the sign's gone. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and just like a dinosaur national park in Colorado, 30 years ago, they were saying that the dinosaur bones were all laid down slowly by a riverbed. Well, that was so silly. Over time, the evidence mounted against that. And so the last time we were out there a couple years ago, we were astonished when the park ranger said in his tour that the dinosaur bones were buried by some catastrophic type of flood. If we could just get them to say the biblical flood, then we're there.
Then we're there. That's right. And you and I have talked about how Christian organizations become worldly over time. Christian hospitals end up doing abortions. Harvard, Princeton, and Yale become atheistic, and denominations turn against God. But it will be interesting to see what happens with these creation ministries, because their only purpose for existing is the foundation of God's word, special creation of man, and a recent creation of the universe.
That's right. And where you see these Christian organizations that have crumbled and gone into hell in a handbasket, so to speak, they all began with a compromise of Genesis. If you look at all the denominations that are secularly liberal and support things like abortion, homosexuality, adultery, they all began with a compromise on Genesis and rejecting the truth of Genesis and believing in millions of years, believing that there was no global flood. And when you start to compromise on the very first book in the Bible, why is it a surprise that people are going to start compromising then on things like, did Christ rise from the dead? Mm-hmm. And so the whole rest of the Bible stands or falls on the truth of Genesis, in my opinion.
This article on these bristlecone pines, toward the very end of the article, one of the sources that the author references is a Smithsonian publication on multiplicity of growth layers in trees and the fact that they don't grow one ring per year. And so the author of this study, there were a couple authors. The first mentioned, his name is Glock, W.S. Glock. And I'd like to read a summary, but Glock in the Smithsonian publication found that about 99% of extremely thin rings and partial rings were false rings. And by false rings, that meant they were not annual rings. So if there was a drought, the drought would create a very thin ring. Some of the rings are so thin that they're made of only a single cell. You can't get thinner than that in a tree ring. So he said 99% of the extremely thin rings and partial rings, a tree would start to form a ring and then it would stop because it just couldn't do it. It didn't have the resources to complete the ring. He said 99% of the extremely thin rings and partial rings were false rings, i.e. they were not annual rings. Well, it turns out the White Mountain bristlecone pines with thousands of rings, they abound in thin and partial rings.
Yeah, and the article points out that they're really indistinguishable from a true annual ring.
Right.
So that's going to lead to ages that are way too old for these trees.
Right. So here's what I did as a creationist. I saw this evidence used by evolutionists. Look, even these tree rings in California, they prove, Bob, that the earth is over 7,000 years old before any kind of global flood. So the Bible is just wrong. So I took that and I said, you know what? It seems to me that there's probably multiple rings per year. But it seems too weak of an answer for me to just say it's multiple rings per year. So my answer is I can't fully respond to that. I don't know. And I've been looking, I've been reading articles on bristlecone pines for the last 3 years or so. And so finally, what a fabulous job of pulling together all this information so that now it is open and shut. Bristlecone pines form multiple rings per year because of drought.
And it should be rejected by scientists as an argument that the Earth is over 7,000 years old.
Very good.
I have a feeling, like so many other paradigms, it's going to be a hard death for it.
Yeah. Where do we go next in this fabulous, the Journal of Creation out of Australia?
Okay, well, if we go back to where we left off, the next article is on the mysterious hobbit, again, where they're trying to turn a human into an ape. So either the evolutionists either find an ape and they try to turn it into a human. I find it funny that they admit that there's no fossil record of the great apes. Well, it's because you keep turning them into humans.
That's interesting.
I have a quote from an evolutionist from a textbook that there's no fossil record of the great apes.
So gorillas, if we want to find fossil evidence of gorillas evolving, they can't find any because everything they find, they say, oh, that evolved into Homo sapiens.
Exactly.
Right. It's all make-believe, so it doesn't make sense. Wherever you look at it from whichever direction, it all falls apart. So back a few years ago, October 2004, Lord of the Rings was huge.
Yep.
And so the journal Nature, very prestigious evolutionary journal, the mother lode of evolutionary Big Bang claims, in October 2004, they published this article about a hobbit. A lost race of human hobbits had been uncovered on an Indonesian island. And so, of course, they want to say these are apes and these apes evolved into human beings somewhere along that process. Maybe it's a tree, maybe it's a bush, but they're part of the story. You recall how the story continued?
Oh, yeah, I do. When it first came out, it was actually one that, you know, normally when you get these kind of stories, it takes a while for them to be refuted. You know, sometimes a couple months, even a couple years to tens, you know, to decades.
Right.
In this case,
Immediately,
a scientist in, let's see here, Adelaide, University of Adelaide, came out and said right away that he recognized that these skulls were very similar to a 4,000-year-old microcephalic modern human skull found on the island of Crete. Now, what microcephalic means is that's a disease. And
yeah,
it gives
abnormal smallness of the skull.
Exactly.
Right.
And so he's saying, wait a minute, we've already found a skull of this, and we know it's of a modern human.
Right, exactly.
And so it caused a big firestorm because everybody, all the secularists want this to be a missing link, and yet right out of the gate, this wasn't a missing link, but they tried. Again, these things die hard, and
so now,
the battle's been going on since then.
And there's increasing evidence that this hobbit is a pygmy human being on an island, and islands tend to produce dwarfism in different living species. And they said, well, look at the arms of this hobbit. The arms are long with respect to the legs. And okay, that was a good point when they looked at the skeleton. By the way, they think this thing was about 18,000 years old. But other researchers then come to the table and they say, well, we have measured pygmies, human pygmies. Thousands of them have been measured. And those measurements show that compared to taller people, pygmies have relatively short legs, but relatively long arms. And so that's not a surprise that a pygmy-type person would have longer arms compared to his overall body height. That's not a surprise. And it turns out also that very close to the cave on this Indonesian island where they found this supposed hobbit creature, they have a village of pygmies living to this day.
That's right.
Yeah.
Some of them suffering that same condition.
Yeah, to this day. And so it's a disease of the smallness of the skull. It's called microcephaly, and it's a real problem. Now, evolutionists, so here's what they did. They said, okay, we're going to compare this skull to Homo sapiens, to Homo erectus, to a human microcephalic. In other words, they took one person with that disease. And also we're going to compare it to human pygmies, to great apes, to Australopithecus. And so what they published, and this was in the journal Science. Do we call Science a journal or a magazine?
A journal.
It was in 2005 in the journal Science. And they said, lo and behold, this brain was not a microcephalic. It wasn't, because it didn't match the one we looked at. So other scientists said, now, wait a minute. Why would you compare it to one? Because there is so much variation in someone who has a disease where their skull is too small. So only a half a year later, another paper was also published in Science, but this was very brief, and they compared this hobbit skull to 19 microcephalic modern humans, to 19. And let me quote to you from that brief article. It said, both skull and brain of microcephalics are extremely varied and grossly resemble the anatomy and proportions of the hobbit. Right? So this is their knee-jerk reaction. Whenever they find some human with rickets that seems to be older, they'll say, oh, this is an evolutionary, you know, progression toward man. This is not human. Neanderthals are not human. And so there's this overwhelming evidence that they are human, but those who want to undermine the simple story of the Bible, they want them to be not human.
They try really, really hard to make to change the facts to fit their story.
So they turn humans, how do you say that? They turn
monkeys into humans or humans into monkeys.
Either way.
In this case, they're trying to turn a human into a monkey.
Yeah, that's right. So they're satisfied either way, right?
Because
they want to blur the distinction when God made man after his image and his likeness. That separated man from all the animals. But people who are in rebellion against God and his word, they don't like that. Toward the end of this article, the author writes about a professor of development genetics at Pennsylvania State University, along with other experts, and they studied the cranial features of the hobbit, and they reported finding 140 cranial features. I didn't know you could find 140 cranial features in a skull, but they reported finding 140 cranial features that place the hobbit, and I'll quote now these scientists, within modern human ranges of variation resembling Australomelanese human populations. So human populations that they call Australomelanese, they said this skull fits in to those kinds of humans.
Yep.
In 140 different ways. And their study also documented, and this is significant, that a creature that has no chin, right? Evolutionists will say, well, look at this. There's no chin. There's no protruding chin. There's no chin. That obviously means it's a monkey. Well, their study documented living human beings in that part of the world that have no chin. And so evolutionists could no longer argue, well, look at this. This here skeleton, this was a monkey. A monkey that buried its dead and made musical instruments and so on.
Well, I'm sure if they'd have found one with an indent in the chin, too, they would have somehow tried to make that a monkey. You know, Kirk Douglas was a monkey.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and they draw these simplistic pictures, and they say, look at this. Look at the brain size. The brain size gets from smaller to bigger to bigger to bigger. And so that shows human evolution, that we got more intelligent. And is that science?
No.
I mean, somebody that has a small brain, a small head, compared to somebody with a big head, big-headed human beings are smarter than small-headed people. I can think of two couples I know, one younger, one in their golden years. And both cases, the husband is big, and the wife is tiny. The wife's brain is probably half the size of the husband's. And in both cases, the wife is way smarter than the husband. And it is funny. Think of Japanese students in a university, right, compared to jocks from the football team and the basketball team. And their head sizes are so different. In fact, the normal range among humans, some normal humans have brains that are three times larger than other normal humans, almost three times larger. That's not an indication of increasing intelligence. It is
exactly.
So bizarre.
It's silly.
Yeah, it really is silly. So, okay, so where do we go now, Fred? So that's the story of the hobbit.
Okay.
The hobbit was a human being, pygmy, with microcephaly. That is a small skull.
That's right.
A disease.
Okay, the next part of the journal, there's quite a few book reviews, and I think there was one that you wanted to touch on, the Hugh Ross
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The book reviews are great in here. And there's one book that was co-authored by Hugh Ross. And we're interested in him because he's an old Earth creationist.
Yeah. They call themselves progressive creationists. Mm-hmm. They don't believe that we all evolved from a pile of slime.
Right.
They basically believe, for example, in regards to hominids, that God created all these hominids over time, and then he created humans. Mm. And so one of the things that this review does is critique a lot of those claims.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this Hugh Ross, he started a group called Reasons to Believe, and we have a natural interest in them because a few years ago I got to debate their Denver chapter downtown in front of about 100 people in the audience. You were there, right?
Oh, yeah, it was great.
It was a lot of fun. In fact, we still sell that debate. It's called the Age of the Earth Debate. You can listen to it. It's about 2.5 hours audio along with many science slides. You get it from us on a CD. And we sell it, and I think they try to forget that it ever happened.
They're not selling it.
They're not selling it.
They admitted afterwards that they got slaughtered.
A number of them did. There was one atheist physicist who flew in from Seattle. He posts on theologyonline.com. And after the debate, he came up to me. He said, "Bob, I'm an atheist. I believe the earth is billions of years old, but you slaughtered him. You wiped him out." And we did wipe him out. And we used science to disprove theories of billions of years and the Bible to establish a young age of the earth and the universe. And it was very powerful. And people could hear it to this day.
Yeah, and these are professing Christians, the Reasons to Believe group, and so not only did they get slaughtered scientifically, but theologically as well. In fact, I believe the debate started more on the theological arguments, and the speaker, Bob, that you had with you is a teacher at Maranatha School that we highly recommend.
Science High School.
And he started his presentation by talking in Hebrew.
Yeah, speaking in Hebrew. He reads the Hebrew text, the Genesis 1, and that's Don Daly. And they were making these claims that are just flat out false. And so one on the other team, he said, "Well, there's this Hebrew scholar that says that these days can refer to long periods of time." So I said, "I'll see your one Hebrew scholar and raise you 60, because I have here a quote that not a single Hebrew scholar from any leading university anywhere in the world will dispute that the author of Genesis intended us to add up the ages of the chronologies to go from the first day of creation through to Abraham and the global flood and so on." So that is the understanding of the world as regards the intention of the author of Genesis for those who are expert in Hebrew and Judaism.
Yeah, many of these Hebrew experts are not. They're not believing Jews, and so they really don't have a stake in this debate. They could care less about us creationists arguing about what Genesis says, but they're clear that they say the text is written as history and not as poetry.
Well, this is Real Science Friday with Fred Williams. Fred, we're out of time. Could we postpone this book review, and we'll do other articles out of this Journal of Creation for another episode?
Sure.
All right, that sounds great. Hey, you can get information on creation, evolution, and the global flood from Bob and Yart Live. You could call us 800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. And you could buy our BEL Science Pack. Or we have so many wonderful subscriptions. You could call us, ask for our catalog, or go to our website, kgov.com. And maybe we'll give you over the next week a Journal of Creation if you order the Science Pack or a subscription from us. How'd that be? And Maranatha Christian Center, what a great school. And thank you, Fred Williams.
Thank you, Bob.